Welcome to PMA Takes on Tech, the podcast that explores the problems, solutions, people, and ideas that are shaping the future of the produce industry. I'm your host, Bonnie Estes, Vice President of Technology for the Produce Marketing Association, and I've spent years in the ag tech sector. So I can attest, it's hard to navigate this ever-changing world in developing and adopting new solutions to industry problems. Thanks for joining us and for allowing us to serve as your guide to the new world of produce and technology. My goal of the podcast is to outline a problem in the produce industry and then discuss several possible solutions that can be deployed today. PMA Takes on Tech is powered by Driscoll's. Driscoll's is the global market leader of fresh strawberries, blueberries, raspberries, and blackberries. With more than 100 years of farming heritage, Driscoll's is a pioneer of berry flavor innovation and the trusted consumer brand of only the finest berries. We are also powered by supply chain visibility leader, Sensatech. Hello, and welcome to this episode of PMA Takes on Tech. As I promised, I'm going to do some virtual travel this year and focus on technology and regions outside of North America. In this episode, we travel to Australia. In 2018, the National Farmers Federation set a goal to grow Australia's agriculture to a $100 billion industry by 2030. Although there seems to be a lot of talk about that number being too small and that they are already falling short, from a distance, it seems to be a great ambition that drives action. Global warming and diminishing natural resources present obstacles to meeting the goal. So too does the rising cost of energy, labor, fertilizer, seeds, and herbicides. These challenges have created the perfect environment for ag tech to grow. Australia has thriving ag tech clusters, world-class life sciences institutions that bring together industry, academia, and government to commercialize new products and processes. I'm lucky to speak first to Sarah Nolette and Matthew Pryor, partners in both Agthentic, an advisory group, and Tenacious Ventures, an ag tech-focused VC. We have an enlightening conversation about why AgTech innovation is happening in Australia now. Australia has had early exposure to climate variability with a brutal drought. Water efficiency was needed and driven by policy and innovation. Australia is also looking at creating marketplaces around sources like soil carbon. And Australia, like most everywhere, is suffering from a labor shortage. Sarah and Matthew saw an opportunity to help develop the ag tech ecosystem in Australia by advising, investing in, and supporting startups. Let's drop into the conversation with Sarah and Matthew. Well, thanks both of you so much for speaking to me today from Australia. It's great to have you.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks, buddy.
Great. So in prepping for this, I had to look back on your backgrounds and how long you've been working together and everything. So you've been working together, at least in your current ventures, for 2.5 years at Agthentic and then now at Tenacious Ventures as well. So how did you meet and how did this start?
Yeah, Matthew is actually one of the first people I met when I came to Australia 5 years ago now. I didn't know anyone in Australian agriculture or really in Australia and was interested obviously in getting involved in agriculture and ag tech. And there had just been a conference, I think, where Matthew wrote some kind of op-ed about ag tech and the opportunity. And so I reached out to him wanting to connect with folks in the space. And I think I'd been here like 2 months, hadn't really been out of my apartment because I was writing my master's thesis. And he was like, yeah, just call me. And I remember being nervous because I was like, he's going to have an Australian accent and I haven't talked to any Australians yet. And so I don't know how that's going to go. And I called him and obviously he was super nice and also was like, oh, I'd love to, you know, co-write an article with you about this, or we should work together. And was just super knowledgeable and helpful about this space. I think we were talking about irrigation at that time. And there happened to be a conference coming up that in Sydney that he was going to. And so I ended up getting a ticket and we met there. And then sort of for the next 2 years ended up seeing each other every couple months at different conferences and always made time to kind of catch up and hang out. And I think over that, you know, course of what ended up being a couple of years, just continued to find that we were really aligned in what we wanted to achieve and the opportunity to work together.
Very cool. So in looking at both of your backgrounds, so Matthew, you're a computer science software guy by training. And Sarah, you probably never get introduced this way anymore, but you went to MIT and Tufts, and probably nobody talks about that anymore, but also in computer science and engineering. So how, Matthew, why don't we start with you, but why ag? Like, how did you end up in ag?
Yeah, maybe one of the reasons that Sarah could understand me is I actually lived and worked in San Francisco for 7 years, kind of in the dot-com era. I had grown up in a decently large country town and sort of, you know, grew up in and around agriculture. So kind of had a bit in my blood, I suppose, from childhood. But yeah, had done the kind of tech tour of duty, at least from an Aussie point of view, you know, kind of spent pretty formative 6 or 7 years in the kind of late 90s, early aughts with a company that I was co-founder of. You know, it was amazing to see and to be there through that whole kind of dot-com madness. But I think I probably also came out the other end feeling a little bit jaded, like computers and technology held such promise and the best we could do was kind of financial services, software, and a whole lot of things that really didn't seem to add up to much on the other side of the dot-com bust. And so when I moved back to Australia, actually through another mutual friend, kind of got an opportunity just to actually apply technology to agriculture. And it was really the first time I thought about that. And really from that minute onward, it was just so obvious that that's what technology should be doing. You know, there were so many opportunities. And Australia at the time was kind of in the teeth of, a very long and extended drought and, you know, so water use efficiency. And just seemed like there was any number of really big challenges that kind of what I had learned in that Silicon Valley experience seemed perfectly well applied to.
Cool. And Sarah, I was listening to your wonderful podcast this morning, AgTech So What, when I was running, and there was the episode with the four women who didn't come from ag. And I love that. It's such a great episode. I recommend it to anyone to listen to, you know, some really different voices. So how did you end up in ag?
Thanks. Love the plug for AgTech So What. Thank you. I guess there are a few pieces came together. So I didn't grow up on a farm, grew up in Silicon Valley, but we had a hobby farm since I was about 12 that I spent time on. I always joke that it was a rock and squirrel farm because we didn't grow anything commercially, but spent a bit of time there. Definitely had parents who cared about the environment, spent a lot of time in the woods, but very much thought ag was something that you do later in life as a, you know, buy a farm and have it be a hobby farm kind of thing. I just didn't really understand it at all. It wasn't until I went to South America on a accidental year-long, you know, gap in my career and lived on a bunch of farms that I really became hooked on everything Matthew just said, the full potential of technology to revolutionize the food system and really break some of the trade-offs that have currently existed around sustainability and productivity and helping improve the life for farmers and give consumers, you know, what we want to eat in the ways we want to eat it. And that was a massive opportunity for, you know, commercial outcomes, but also impact outcomes. And I went down the ag rabbit hole and haven't come out since and don't plan to.
Great. So the company that you first started, AgThentic, is mostly a consulting company, right? That's the most of your work. And so what had you decide to, as far as I can tell, you're still doing that and you're still doing the podcast, which is amazing to me. And then what made you start Tenacious Ventures? What made you think that was something you wanted to do and that there was a need for that?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, so we talked a little bit about how, you know, Sarah and I started to work together more, and that's really where the advisory side of the business kind of comes into it. So, you know, still a lot of what we do is helping bring those kind of forces together of technology, of investment, of agriculture and agricultural research. The more we spent time in those areas and kind of bringing those parties together, we would just keep seeing opportunities where there were these very promising young companies who had the right combination of, you know, inside and applying technology in the right way, not technologies for technology's sake. But we really struggled to convince other people to invest in them. And not because there wasn't passion, not because there wasn't understanding of how big the opportunity was, but just it's a complex area, right? Like getting your head around, you know, what do farmers really want and how are we going to see a return and what kinds of technologies are going to be really impactful here. You know, you do have to get a lot on board. And it, eventually it just became obvious that the right solution is a VC firm dedicated exclusively to, you know, kind of broadly agri-food innovation. And that's what Tenacious was. That's why we started it. And that was kind of the commencement of the journey, was just realizing that you just had to be fully convicted in that area and have a VC firm that was doing that and that, nothing but.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Sorry, Moni. It also gave, I think, a real opportunity for us to implement and take action on the insights we were gaining from the advisory work. And what I personally, you know, and Matthew would be the same. I think neither of us wanted to be consultants or see ourselves as consultants in any way, because the idea of just writing a report or a PowerPoint that doesn't get actioned is not particularly interesting to either of us. But having the opportunity to dig really deep and solve problems for our clients who will implement it, and also leverage those insights to figure out which founders to back who will also implement, just gives us multiple ways to really catalyze action and impact around the things we're learning and kind of close the loop between insights around what actually gets adopted and action around innovations that need to be created. And so that's, I think, how it kind of comes together in terms of doing both the investing and the advisory work, and then the podcast and content platform to bring it to life and create opportunities like this to speak with others in the space.
That's really interesting. I mean, I started working in, we didn't even call it ag tech, but it was a lot of advanced breeding technologies and GMOs and that type of thing very early on in my career, many, many years ago, and have worked on trying to develop new technologies and get new technologies out there. And then living here in Silicon Valley, you know, in the last 8 years or so, when suddenly ag tech is a thing, and watching this evolution of the VCs in this area, where at the beginning there weren't any, you know, that really understood ag, and it was all what you were saying, you know, it's just people didn't understand it. They were used to, like, you know, product 1.0 comes out in 6 months, product 2.0 comes out, you know, in a year. And you start talking to them, especially my area was more in biology, and trying to talk to them about, no, this could be 10 years. You know, it just was, it was a real struggle. And it's been interesting to watch that evolution here. And it sounds like, you know, you guys are going through the same thing and kind of making and that happen and facilitating that in Australia, which is super exciting. So what are the biggest problems that you see need to be solved in the ag and food system, you know, in your region where you are?
Yeah, I mean, look, some of it goes back to the kind of early analogy of there are some things about Australia and Australia's kind of climate that really create some of that opportunity. So I think, you know, we talked about what Australians now call the kind of millennium drought, this very extended, you know, kind of 7 to 10 year period where it sort of felt, and I think now feels a lot like we were sort of on the leading edge of being exposed to significant climate variability. And, you know, to our government's credit, there was a lot of innovation there in a water policy sense. You know, you could spend a whole episode of a podcast that are talking about just that. But what that innovation really kind of drove was sort of showed that there was significant kind of opportunities, both in sort of, you know, policy incentive areas, but also technology. So if we wanted to really move the needle on something like water use efficiency, that technology was going to be something really important there. We're now kind of seeing that also play out in key areas like kind of soil health and the relationship between soil health and soil carbon. So there's kind of this, you know, kind of early exposure to climate variability and what is going to be the response to that. We're seeing that also play out now in kind of nature-based solutions and the intersection of, you know, creating marketplaces for nature-based solutions and you know, how farmers are going to meaningfully participate in those sorts of things. You know, those are two pretty key ones.
I would add just another one, kind of not totally unique to Australia, but on the forefront of many minds right now is labor availability, which of course is true in the US, but exacerbated by COVID and border restrictions, again, globally, but especially in Australia, and one that, you know, is particularly well suited to technological solutions. I wouldn't say either of us believe in, you know, robots will fully replace humans and we should all just live on the beach and you know, drive our drones. But for sure, there are technology enabling factors that can help improve those labor challenges. And we expect Australia to be a leader there as well.
Great. So in your work with startups and advancing technology this way, sometimes startups are good, sometimes VCs are good, sometimes maybe it's better to have a larger company, you know, that has more staying power. Like, how do you see how startups fit into the ecosystem and how maybe policy or other ways might be better solutions?
Yeah, I mean, we talked a little bit about like why Australia, and some of that is, you know, we have always largely defined ourselves as a producer of food and fiber and significantly for export. And so, but at the same time, we're one of the least protected agricultural economies in the world. And the way we've achieved that is actually by being a really significant investor in R&D and in agricultural research. It's, you know, in the order of $700 or $800 million a year in Australia, which is a significant sum in kind of relative terms. And so there is this baseline of research-based innovation that has kept us, you know, at a roughly a kind of 2% improvement over kind of three decades in terms of, you know, gross kind of farm output productivity. That's been really significant. But that doesn't really account for how do we take those innovations to the rest of the world. So I think increasingly this idea of kind of research as a way of coming up with core innovations, startups and investments, then is really a new kind of vehicle to see those innovations being taken to market, you know, is definitely working well in Australia. It will be, you know, still sort of emerging and growing, but also thinking about that then as, okay, that's also a platform where these innovations can be taken to the rest of the world. So, I think we are absolutely convinced that startups are one of the key mechanisms, not because they're necessarily replacing or supplanting anything else that's there, but really significantly augmenting the ability of those kind of core innovations to get powerfully into the hands of farmers in ways that farmers want to take delivery of them. You know, there's one thing that things that startups do really well, it's kind of eventually find the right way to take a solution to market. And that, you know, that pivoting and all that kind of stuff, that's the way that you find how customers actually want to take hold of that innovation and powerfully use it. So that's why I think, you know, startups will deliver really well in agriculture, not because any given one of them gets it right, but eventually they get it right. When you have that 1,000 shots on goal, you know, eventually someone kind of cracks the code. And I think that's really why, you know, we see a lot of power in the startup model.
Was there a culture? I know I worked in Brazil years ago, and there was certainly not a culture in Brazil that startups made sense. And I talked to a number of people in Brazil about it. And they said, look, when you start a company in Brazil, you're starting it to pass it on to your children. Like, that's the culture. You know, if you have to sell your company, it means you did something wrong. And so there, that's certainly changed over the last 10 years. There's a great startup culture in Brazil now, but it really took, like, they were sending tons of people to Silicon Valley and like trying to, you know, kind of train in entrepreneurship into something that didn't exist in the culture as much. So do you find that thinking of doing a startup and, you know, that's in the culture, or have you had to develop that a little?
Yeah, not naturally. I'm really smiling because when the first company I was co-founder of, which we you know, took over 10 years to kind of build, it was eventually acquired, and my father-in-law was horrified for that exact reason. It's like, you can't sell that. It's like, you know, it's your thing. I would say decently similar in that way. It's changed a lot, but I would say, you know, in this current generation is really where that change is taking place.
Well, I think seeing some exits, you know, like that's always a good motivator, and you were one, right? So that's a positive.
I would also add for me, you know, I've only been here 5 years, but the just shock of how culturally different it was in terms of startups. I probably wasn't prepared from having lived in the bubbles of Silicon Valley in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where, you know, you go to a Starbucks and everyone's talking about the idea they're going to hatch and pitching their dad or grandfather, you know, grandmother on it left and right. And I remember working with startups in the early days of AgThentic, and they were trying to hire and grow the teams. And I would meet people and say, you know, should come check out this company and come work with us. And over and over again, I met young people and talented people who would go through the interview process with these growing companies, get to the end and go, no, I'm going to go work for a bank. No, I'm going to go work for a consulting company. And it was like my parents said, and my grandfather said, you know, all these influences of just getting this safe job and taking this tried and true career path. And I was really floored in the beginning. And so a lot of the early thinking in terms of AgThentic and ecosystem growth and now Tenacious was around how do we get more talent and how do we inspire more people to consider innovation? And that's including non-traditional innovators, you know, like farmers and others who aren't maybe thinking about entrepreneurship in terms of what they do, but that's absolutely what they're doing. And we need those kinds of people to be involved in the ag tech ecosystem. Otherwise it won't be successful.
Yeah, that's great. So you touched on this a little bit, and it may not be quite a fair question because neither of you have spent your whole careers in ag and in the US, but what do you see are kind of the differences about agriculture and about the ag tech ecosystem between Australia and the US?
Yeah, I would say when I first came here, sort of looking around for the commodity corn and soy markets, you know, that didn't last very long in Australia because they don't exist here. But that said, you know, there are significant grain markets here and they look slightly different, but the similarities between Australia and the US, you know, very much do exist. A couple differences that are interesting, you know, we export, as Matthew had mentioned before, 60%+ of what we produce here, you know, in the Southern Hemisphere, different kinds of growing seasons. In terms of ag retail, I think there are some really interesting differences there that we've dug into that maybe Matthew will touch on. But just briefly in terms of ag tech, it was just such a smaller market here. The number of dollars being spent, the number of players there are, you know, Tenacious launched in late 2018, early 2019, and we're the first dedicated ag tech VC firm. And, you know, there's plenty of room for others and lots of collaborations, but it's just the scale is much smaller. And that plays out in a couple interesting ways. You've got a much smaller consumer market. So thinking about food tech and last mile delivery and those kinds of things just don't make a ton of sense when there's only 25 million Australians and they're in sort of three places. That's just a very different kind of company you'd build versus solving that in New York City or LA, let alone Seoul or somewhere like that. So I would say size of the market therefore size of the ecosystem is really different. But that said, in terms of ag tech, we're building an ag tech ecosystem on the back of quite a established startup ecosystem in Australia. So we've got leaders like Atlassian and Canva in terms of unicorn successful companies and talent coming out of those companies and becoming VCs and starting to close that entrepreneurial loop that we need, and government and policy support. So we've got great R&D tax incentives for innovation. We've got the kind of scheme that Tenacious Ventures is set up under in terms of tax incentives for our investors into the fund. So there's a number of kind of cultural and ecosystem phenomenon and structural policy phenomenon that make Australia's startup ecosystem great. And then ag tech coming into that, albeit slightly late to the game, means we can build on strengths in ag and in startups, but also sort of learn from the lessons of other global ag tech ecosystems to solve ag tech challenges in different ways, like bringing in distribution earlier, involving farmers earlier, more collaboration, et cetera, that I think other ag tech ecosystems maybe haven't done as well at because they were having a go first and we're getting to learn from their ups and downs.
I think actually going back to your cultural question, the other thing we kind of got to get used to is this idea that Australian companies will leave the country, but it's that the best kind of success is for an Australian startup to end up, you know, in the US or Europe or wherever, create successful founders who will eventually come back to the country and bring that experience with them. And so we, you know, we kind of need to embrace that, as, you know, like you were saying, going back to that kind of 10 to 15 year time horizon, that's really the kind of, you know, length of time that we need to be thinking.
So my last question, this one's for Sarah, and kind of a different kind of question, but what I admire about you most as I watch your work with the podcast that we referenced and also with some of the conversations that I've been lucky enough to be in with you is that you have this gift and interest in finding and amplifying new and different voices. And I think that's partly maybe because you're in a different country, but that's what had you go to a different country is because you have that interest. But I work really hard at that, is trying to make sure that, you know, I'm listening to different voices, especially younger voices and voices outside of, you know, the mainstream of where we normally work in ag. And I look at you as one of my sources for new voices. So through the podcasts and other conversations, but is this a, do you think about this? Is this a conscious effort or is this just driven by your natural curiosity?
I would say, first of all, thank you. I really appreciate that. Definitely both. I mean, the podcast in particular started because a combination of I like having these kinds of conversations and wanted an excuse to do it and found it really hard. I'm naturally an introvert. And so going to a conference or a workshop with often a bunch of farmers or ag industry experts who look, you know, who are older, who are have more experience in the industry, who bring a very different perspective than I would bring, or I bring a different perspective than they would bring, just the excuse to say, you know, we have this podcast and do you want to come share your story? I find is a really helpful conversation opener and way to build a relationship. And that it creates so many opportunities and also interesting content that we can leverage and they can leverage and kind of gets these different ideas out there. So that was kind of the selfish reasons, I suppose, for it. And then what's exciting about agriculture and maybe the world we live in with ag tech and venture capital, but also farming and the equipment and retail and chem is there are, like, that is all changing. And there are both absolute critical needs for the longstanding experts in this industry who have been doing the innovation, have been building these companies, have had this expertise, but also new voices who think about these kinds of things differently and challenge perspectives and bring in different kinds of skills. And if we don't embrace that, then I don't think we can be successful in building the kind of food system we all want in the future. And so giving a platform to and highlighting the ideas of really different kinds of voices is part of having an impact. And so we're, you know, excited to play a small role in that.
That's great. That's a great answer. Thank you for that. I was talking to a company here in the US yesterday, and they have been doing this big landscape of listening to different voices and trying to, you know, figure out how they fit. And they were saying one of the things that they found in interviewing hundreds of people in ag in the US is that there's a lack of there's a changing in the guard of leadership. A lot of the leadership, you know, in ag is starting to retire and move into other interests. And people are kind of looking around for, like, well, who should we listen to now? And things are changing so much. And so I think it's this really important time to be so much more inclusive, you know, globally and types of people of all different diversity, to really bring different conversations into ag. So I appreciate the work that you do there. And I appreciate both of you so much for having this conversation. It's been really interesting, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Awesome.
Thanks so much, Bonnie.
Sarah and Matthew are really pioneers. I watch closely to what they are interested in. Next, we will hear from two companies in Australia about their technology and products. First up is Dr. Nancy Shellhorn, the co-inventor and co-founder of Rapid Aim Insect Sensing Technologies. I really love what they are doing and the effect they will have globally on pest management. I think you'll enjoy her story. Secondly, we will hear from Andrew Bate, founder of Swarm Farm Robotic Agriculture. Swarm Farm is one of a handful of companies globally to have delivered autonomous robots to commercial farmers. Swarm Farm's autonomous machines have sprayed, weeded, and mowed more than 200,000 acres of farmland over the past 2 years. Both of these entrepreneurs say Australia is a great place to be, and both have global expansion plans. Nancy says in Australia, your solution has to solve a real problem. There's no money for hype. She also gets the benefit of product development without seasonal delay with the country's large latitude span. Andrew says most of the major machine manufacturers release and test in Australia before they release their product on the global market due to the tough farming environment there. So if you can make it in Australia, you can make it anywhere. Let's jump into the conversation with Nancy. So please tell me about your company.
Well, we're Rapid Aim, pest forecast news and alerts. Basically, we help farmers reduce the risk of loss and cost from insect pests. So, you know, as we know, insect pests are a huge threat to food crops, but so is the way that we manage them. Insecticides are really precise tools to kill insects, but mostly farmers use insecticides as insurance just in case a pest is present because, you know, they can't take the risk. Insects are super small, they're highly mobile, they can move into a crop and lay eggs, and you know, larvae can hatch and start to feed before farmers even know that there's a problem. And so it's really a way to minimize risk. But what's happened is that there's tremendous amount of overuse then, and insecticides end up where they shouldn't. And I think one small example of this is now we're seeing some of the most effective tools in the world being banned or restricted. So crop protection is really changing, moving much more to digital and biological, and that's where Rapid Aim comes in. So basically we are an enabling technology for efficient delivery of crop protection, and it's a digital solution.
That's great. And one of the pests that I've seen that you focused on is the fruit fly. That's one of the things that you've done a lot of work on, right?
Yeah, we started with fruit fly because it's the world's number one biosecurity barrier to trade. So basically, no country wants another country's fruit fly pest. And there's many, many different species. So it means that there are mandatory requirements around monitoring for fruit fly. And this is done today manually. So millions of fruit fly traps that contain an attractant, mostly for male fruit flies, are placed in areas of production and then even through urban areas. And then someone goes out and checks these by hand every 7 to 14 days. As a small example, you know, you'd be familiar with the situation in California with fruit flies. There are about 94,000 fruit fly traps in California alone. And at peak season, a staff of about 400. And all they do is they go around and they look inside these traps to see if there are any fruit flies, whereas 98% of the time they're empty. And so that's why we started with monitoring for fruit fly to basically have a real-time alert so there wasn't a delay. So you can imagine that delay of 7 to 14 days also means hundreds of fruit fly eggs and babies can be laid into fruit. And so the problem can take off very, very quickly, but also just the cost of managing that is huge. So that's why we started there, because of the already in place mandatory requirement. But now we are absolutely moving in to pest management more generally. And we also started with high value fruit and nut agriculture, because anytime I think you bring a technology to play and we deal in low volumes, just the cost. So the margins are a bit better in high value. But now we're moving into row crops, trying to address the early detection and suppression of highly mobile global grain pests, particularly fall armyworm.
Oh, interesting. That's interesting. Yeah, a lot of companies go the other direction because, especially in the US, you know, row crops are so much bigger. And I've worked with a lot of companies that say, well, if we can only get 1% of the US corn market, that's a lot. but it's hard, you know, it's hard to break into that. But I love that you started in the crop area that I care the most about. And I think it's fascinating the work that you've done there. One of the things when I was reading about the actual product is that it's a sensor. It's not a camera, right? So talk a little bit about like what actually you're putting out there and kind of how it feeds information up to the cloud.
Yeah. So our IP is really about our novel ultra low power sensor. So it's a capacitance sensor, which is the same type of technology that you use on a smartphone when you unlock it with your fingerprint ID. So it's based on disrupting electrical fields. And so there are two sensors at Then as an insect encounters the trap, as they come into the trap to come towards the attractant, then there are algorithms that sit underneath the sensor that allow us to detect and discriminate the insects that are entering the trap. Insects have a range of shapes and sizes and behaviors, and that's what our algorithms do. And then there's all the smarts are there on the piece of hardware, the trap. And so it's edge computing where some onboard processing happens, and then the data is sent to the cloud and then to the end user's mobile app in real time. So there's no back-end processing of images. We started with camera-based technology, which is most of our competitors used in 2010. We moved away from it because our objective has always been to have a tight link with management so that growers could actually see where and when a pest showed up and have a really targeted management strategy, and then to know whether their management was working. And so that meant that we needed to deploy sensors at the appropriate scale, the appropriate density, whereas camera-based technology is deployed at a very low density. So what you often end up with is a trend over time of pest, but not a very good spatial assessment of where the pests are. So we took the risk and we moved away from camera-based technology to our ultra-low power sensor technology. And that's proved to was a very good decision. It allows us to scale massively. So right now, we only started our sales in January last year, not quite a year ago. And we have about 500 sensors deployed across the country, from the top end of Australia all the way down to north of Melbourne. We can roll out grids. So we like our go-to-market strategies. We like to go in and take over an entire horticultural region. So we deploy sensors across an entire region first, and that allows us to deliver our alerts and forecasts. And then we upsell to growers where they can put multiple sensors on their property to really have on-farm security about where and when the pests are showing up on their farm or in their orchard. And then that's just there. They just get to see their own data and then act quickly.
So the actual producer is your customer. That's who you're selling to. But you have sensors over a whole area, like you said.
That's right.
That was the thing that was so interesting to me, is like a lot of times with the type of data that we're gathering, you have to go to growers. They have to be willing to give you their data. You have to collect their data. Then you have to, get everybody else's data and try to integrate everything. And it's really difficult. But with your sensors, being able to go across the whole area and kind of seeing what's coming and seeing what's there and be more predictive is, I think, what makes it really exciting.
Yeah, we started and I think this is really an important part of our business strategy, but most importantly, too, about the way in which we manage pests. So, global pests don't recognize farm boundaries. They really work across huge areas, and therefore our technology needs to basically align nicely with that. So by going in and putting out sensors across an entire region, we can do then is we can see where the pests are across an entire region, but it also means a low barrier to entry product. So that first product for us, our forecast and alerts, is just delivered as an SMS to a grower. And it basically tells them what's happening in their region, how close is the problem to their property. It's not a huge investment by the grower to first start to get a feel for what RapidAIM can deliver to them. And then once they see that, we upsell for their farm. We can send them the sensors and they can roll them out. So it's a super simple to use plug and play device as well. And in fact, during COVID, we demonstrated that we're COVID resilient, and it's basically a low touch system and the customers can self-serve. So we ship them the devices. They download the app, they scan the QR code. Those traps then all become registered to their properties. They plug in the battery, hang it in a tree, and their whole grid goes live. That's it. There's no big star pickets with solar panels or batteries. And again, that's one of the advantages of using ultra-low power sensors as opposed to camera-based, because our batteries, we use two small lithium-ion batteries, and we get a maximum of 18 months battery life and a minimum to 12. So again, the goal has been low maintenance, scalable, but delivering valuable information to the grower to be able to have confidence about when pests aren't there and to know when their management's working.
In this particular episode, as we've talked about, I'm trying to look at companies and what's happening outside of North America. And it's very interesting to see there's so much innovation in Australia. It's just amazing to me. And as we know, these insects and especially fruit flies are really a worldwide problem. And as you talk about, this is a huge barrier to trade because everyone's concerned about crossing different global lines. So this is obviously a worldwide problem. What are your plans to expand outside of Australia?
Yeah. Well, I guess a couple things. So we do have plans to do that. And I know some companies do that very, very quickly. I think Australia is a fantastic, it's a more than a testing ground, but you know, agriculture isn't subsidized in Australia, with the exception of water. Growers get some government rebates at times for water, which means that solving a problem, you can demonstrate the value of your solution very, very quickly because there isn't that there's no subsidy. So it has to solve a grower's problem and it has to provide value for money. So if you can make it in Australia, I reckon you can make it anywhere because of that. The second thing is, you know, where we sit on the planet in terms of the latitude, just by moving up and down the eastern seaboard, you know, we go from a tropical to subtropical to Mediterranean and temperate climates. Just by going up and down the seaboard, you know, a couple thousand kilometers, you can really continue to test and develop your product without a seasonal delay. And so again, I think that's a really important part about Australia. So, you know, for example, with fruit fly activity, of course, in the winter down south, there's very limited activity of fruit fly. But here in Brisbane, they're going all year round. You know, and even when we have a slight lull in the winter in Brisbane, if we go north 5 hours, there's no delay. And the same for a lot of these pests. And also, I think that's why Australia has such fantastic fresh fruit and veg, because the production is happening just with slight moves up and down the eastern seaboard. But in terms of going overseas, Australia is a very small market. So from a business perspective, we absolutely have interest in going overseas. We've had great conversations with LA County. LA County alone has about 20,000 fruit flies. So we'd like to start some trial with testing our technology with that group. Also, we're now integrating other pests into our sensor. So not just rapid fly for fruit fly, but for production systems such as apples and pears and stone fruit that also deal with moth pest. We have a combo of rapid fly and rapid moth together. So for example, we're now starting the monitoring for things like codling moth and fruit fly within the same sensor. So I think that will be highly attractive to producers in California. And we'd like to say in the next 6 months or so, we will connect with a group in California to start the testing and trialing. We always learn, you know, every time you deploy in a new geography, because there's new pests, there's new situations, we end up learning a lot about how our technology performs, can sometimes need to make small refinements. And so I think that's a good way to start, is with a couple small grids in the Sacramento Valley and San Joaquin Valley to see how our technology is performing there and also the value of our technology for those growers.
That's great. Yeah, I was in Southern California in the 80s, so I was there with all the Malafy on spray and really realized, you know, the problems that can come from these pests. Well, I didn't get to half the questions I was going to ask you, but we need to wrap here. So thank you so much for your time, and I wish you the best of luck on this great technology of, you know, solving a really big problem. So thank you.
Absolute pleasure, Bonnie. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Great conversation with Nancy. I hope she has much success in Australia and is able to expand worldwide. We could certainly use that product in California. Now we will talk to Andrew. Welcome, Andrew Bate, founder of Swarm Farm. Tell us about your company.
Swarm Farm Robotics is an Australian ag tech company. We build autonomous robots. We're probably a little bit unique in that we're very much a soil up company rather than technology down. We started out in rural Australia, and Australia is a very sparsely populated country. We're based right out in a farming area. Our closest capital city would be 700 kilometres away. I'm not sure what that is in miles, but we're right in the heart of farming area, and that's where our customers are, and I'm a farmer myself, so that's probably a big part of our background. But, yeah, it's we're kind of unique in that way, in that we're not in a capital city, and we do all of our development out in regional areas in Australia.
So I was doing prep for this and just looking at your website and watching videos, and you work across many different crop areas. And I watched the video you sent over about your work in apples. So why don't you describe what your technology does in apples and kind of where you are in product development there?
The work we're doing in apples is I guess a more interesting project and kind of a little bit more higher end. So what we're doing there is working an industry project, actually. There was an industry call to develop technology that could help with flower thinning in apple trees. And so what we're doing is actually working at the stage each individual tree each individual tree in the orchard's at. And then we're actually treating each tree when it's at the right stage. So traditionally in an orchard, in apple orchards, farmers go through, they make a decision to thin the flowers, and they spray the entire orchard in one hit. And when that decision's made, some trees are still immature and not quite ready, and they get sprayed too early. Some trees have almost finished flowering and it's a little bit too late. So it's kind of a bit of a hit and miss approach in that it's, you know, you're averaging a whole orchard. What it will do is allow farmers to cut back on their thinning costs. So after the first initial flower thinning, there's a lot of hand thinning that goes on where groups of thinning groups are sent through, and they pull the excess apples off to thin the population into what they want. By doing this earlier in the season with computer vision, we can actually massively impact the actual cost, the man hours of actually thinning those apples later on in the season.
So I was watching the video and I was thinking then, so how, if you're just spraying the orchards or the tree when they need to be sprayed, are you going through the orchard a lot more times then? Or like, how does that work on the timing?
Yeah, it is. And that's one of the beauties of robotics. I mean, if you look at some of the early adoption use of robotics, there's some really high-end things that people want to do, you know, picking fruit, pruning trees, all sorts of stuff that is still quite hard for robotics to do. And there's companies working in that area, and it is coming, and it'll be revolutionary when it gets here, but still a little bit more work to go. A lot of the early use of robotics is really about timing and the number of passes. And we talked to a lot of agronomists and even our early adopter customers about robotics and how it fits in their operation. It's like, it's more about how many passes can I get in one season rather than how many acres can I do in one day, because the more times you can be in a crop, the more opportunities you have to manage and intervene with that crop to do things that you're not doing now. And so in this case, traditionally with thinning flowers in apple orchards, it might be 2-3 thinning operations at the flowering stage. Ultimately, what we're heading towards here is daily thinning operations. So it might be done 10 times over a 2-week period. So each tree gets treated exactly on the day that it's due. And that's something we don't do in agriculture now because it's not practical. Right. But with a robot, it becomes practical. So it's actually changing the agronomy and the decision-making and ultimately growing better crops. So that's a big part of what robotics can do now in these early stages.
What data are you using and how are you analyzing that data to be able to know when the different flower stages and when you need to apply the thinning chemical?
Yeah, so look, I guess there's two things. I mean, it's the technology meeting the agronomy. So we've collected massive data sets over a period of 3 years now at flowering. And then we've gone and validated those results with agronomists. So we actually sent agronomists out with tagged trees and collect all of that data and put it together. And so then we train our algorithms off of that. So to start with, the original approach was we just wanted to know, the number of flowers on each tree, which ended up being kind of a bit of a crude indication of what we actually wanted to know. And we soon discovered that what was more important is what stage the tree's actually at. Has it got to king bloom yet? Or is it still earlier on in the flowering process? So we ended up retraining our algorithms then to actually pick when king bloom's occurring. And so we can base our spraying decisions around that. So what's interesting as we build these data sets is that we can start to do predictive work earlier on and picking how many days to king bloom, so that we can get in and kind of predict when certain trees are going to be sprayed, even ahead of when they're actually due as well, which helps with operations as well.
Great. So you recently, well, October, somewhat recently, just closed a round of funding. Can you tell us about that and what that process was like and how much you raised?
Yeah. Look, we did. It was an interesting time. So we closed, we were COVID closed. So we were close to closing just before COVID came in. And that was the first time we'd raised. So we're a bootstrap company to now. The issues agriculture has around labour and expertise didn't go away in the GFC at all. But it's been interesting in this downturn. Agriculture is just screaming out for people. It's worse than ever in agriculture, trying to find skilled people and staff, and also field staff and pickers of fruit and vegetables and that sort of stuff. Australia's at a really critical stage now where fruit's rotting in the field because they just can't get enough people. And so it's been interesting reflection into some of those VC conversations we had through that closing stage about what was going to happen to agriculture in the, through COVID. If anything, agriculture is stronger than ever. It's a great industry to be in, and I think demand for the sort of technology we're developing is stronger than ever as well. So that's pretty exciting as well. But we raised $4.5 million Australian. Our co-lead investors was Tenacious Ventures. They're Australia's dedicated venture capitalist in ag tech, which is fantastic. We'd worked with them for quite a while previous to them being a VC. So really excited to have them join in. Also, Artesian as well. So Artesian's Australia's biggest VC. They have a fund dedicated to the grains industry and also to clean energy. And so we're invested, they invested through those two funds. Quite exciting for me personally, I guess, in that I'm from the grains industry myself and I'm still a grain grower myself. So to be invested in from my own industry was really exciting. And we also have a government fund here from the Queensland government to get more technology and more, I guess, investment in our state. And the state government invested as well through their Queensland Business Development Fund, so really good to be backed by our own state as well. So it's pretty exciting for us. And we did also we also have a US investor invested in us as well, undisclosed at this stage, but we'll talk more about that in the next few months as well.
That's interesting. I'll have to speculate on that. so that kind of leads to my last question of what are your plans to expand outside of Australia? Because obviously your technology would be really valuable, here in California and the whole apple growing areas. So how do you think about expansion? And you're a pretty small company, a small group, and really finding your niche there. And then what's next?
Yeah, and look, I guess we've done really well to date. Like we've had paying customers commercially running our robots for 2 years now, and we, literally are one of the first companies to commercially hand over the keys and deliver real autonomous robots, and we're really proud of that. We are a small team, and we've developed all of our technology in house. We've got 12 robots out deployed now. We're building one a month, so we'll have another two. We'll get 14 robots very shortly, and we're scaling up from there. So I think of it that we're lucky that we started in Australia. Australia is kind of like a testing ground for ag tech. Even big players like Deere and others in the farm machinery game always deliver into Australia before they deliver into other world markets because it's a testing ground. It's a very tough farming environment, and we're really good at pushing technology to its limits and breaking technology here in Australia because our field conditions are so hard. Hence, we have a really good early adoption, I guess, mindset over here with ag tech. So these early years in Australia have been really good for us. But in terms of overseas, we're thinking about which markets we go to and which crops next. So we've had an enormous amount of interest out of South America, North America, and also Canada. For us, it's picking the right first early adopter customers in those markets, and also which sectors we go into as well. So, you know, we've got robots going into vineyards shortly. So, you know, there's potential to be, you know, which market we target will be interesting. I mean, to date, our base has been around broadacre and row crop, but we're starting to do more in horticulture now and orchards. I guess we've got a fair bit of strategy we'll do now over the next 6 months as to which sector we'll target and which exact region, because you know, it's not about outright sales for us. It's about finding the right early adopters and the right industry to push into. Also, regulatory and those sort of issues too. There's differences between different states as well. So finding the right region as well. So we are interested to talk to early adopters that that you know that want to be a part of this journey.
What I love about talking to all my guests today is how grounded they are in what they do. Sarah and Matthew are working with companies on the ground, building an ecosystem. Nancy, along with other scientists, came from CSIRO as the developers of the science. They are using technology that works, not the most expensive, highest tech cameras, but sensors that have a long battery life with a cost point possible for wide distribution. And Andrew lives and works in rural areas. He knows the problems that need to be solved. He too is not starting with the most expensive, difficult problems to solve, but creating robots that can be deployed now. I so miss traveling. It's not just the places, which of course I miss seeing new places, but I really miss meeting new people in new places with different points of view. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Next best thing to being there. That's it for this episode of PMA Takes on Tech. Thanks for allowing us to serve as your guide to the new world of produce and technology. Be sure to check out all our episodes at pma.com and wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe, and I would love to get any comments or suggestions of what you might want me to take on. For now, stay safe, eat your fruits and vegetables, and we will see you next time.